Hope reigns. When rain pelts earthward, do they heavy down the dust? Do they slowly bust the crust of we can't but know we must? When hopes crash earthward, do they pelt down wet like rain? Do they live to rise again? Are they wounded, hurt, or lame? This morning I would like to speak with you about a journey that I undertook 50 years ago that removed me from the culture I had known through my youth and thrust me into an old culture which, because it was foreign to me, allowed me to call into question most of the precepts that had shaped who I was up to that moment. I had grown up in New England in a middle-class family, son of a high school guidance counselor and a small-town newspaper columnist. In an attempt to expose us to religion, my parents attended several different churches before settling on the old Unitarian Church nearby in the town of Brewster, Massachusetts, that was founded in 1700. There I became active in the liberal religious youth group and attended an LRY assembly in Hingham, Mass. One year. Having inherited dyslexia from my mother's side of the family, I struggled with reading and math and gravitated to the graphic arts, later applying to and being accepted at the architecture school at Washington University in St. Louis. Due to the emphasis on reading and my inability to read fast or well, I failed out my freshman year, much to the chagrin of my parents. I returned to New England to think about whether I really wanted to become an architect, and for much of the next year worked for several engineering and architecture firms in the Boston area before joining the Peace Corps as the youngest member of a group of architects and engineers sent to northeastern India to help bring water to the parched regions of the lower Ganges and upper Subarnarekha river valleys. I was 20 years old. I remember approaching the New Delhi International Airport at night, looking down on the lights of the many scattered villages that surrounded the airport there, thinking about the 650 million inhabitants of many different religions that awaited me, thinking, "Tom, you're not in Kansas anymore." In terms of exposure to different religions, the next 3 years would challenge my liberal Unitarian upbringing in formative ways. As Peace Corps volunteers, we had pledged to do our best to bring water to the people of the Chotanagpur Plateau and Lower Ganges River Valley, specifically Ranchi District and Gaya districts of Bihar. The Gaya district was well known as the place, Bodh Gaya, where Gautama Buddha sat under the Bodhi or people tree, hoping to attain enlightenment. As the story goes, Buddha chose Gaya because it was an extremely harsh climate and he was seeking to be challenged by the powers that were, or perish in the effort. He survived, and we were there to help others do the same by striving to bring clean water to them in their time of need. The ancient Buddhist university, Nalanda, was located in nearby Rajgir, where thousands of monks and students were trained in Buddhist doctrine and dogma to be sent out throughout Asia and the Middle East from the years 427 to 1197 AD to spread the word about Buddhism. It was monks that studied studied in Nalanda that spread Buddhism as far south as Ceylon and east to Thailand, China, and Japan. It was while we were working in the Gaya district of the lower Ganges River Valley, drilling wells to bring water to Hindu and Muslim villages, with the birthplace of Buddhism so nearby, that I began to think about how religions begin, where they come from, and how do they help their adherents live better, more meaningful lives. Sleeping out among the stars at night, looking up at the very same stars that the local Hindu and Muslim villagers were seeing, I could not ignore the fact that though we were all seeing the same stars with our eyes, we interpreted them differently as we passed them through our individual and cultural filters. I was intrigued by these differences, how interesting it was to try to understand the different ways similar things, events, or ideas could be interpreted. We were doing the same thing every day, drilling wells through the mud and down through the fine sand until we reached coarse sand. Then we would pull up the pipe, install a filter on the end of the pipe, then lower it back down into the coarse sand and fit a hand pump to the top of the pipe with a piston and cylinder at or below water table. Simple enough, however, deciding where to locate the well was a completely different process depending on whether we were planning to drill the well in a Hindu or a Muslim village. In the Hindu village, the decision of where to locate the well was complicated by the fact that there were many different castes of inhabitants in that village, and they would all need access to the well. Some of the castes were prohibited from walking on property that belonged to people of a higher caste. Meetings had to be held, debating whether these people could encroach on those people. Sometimes arguments ensued. Usually we found a solution and proceeded to install the well, but not always. In several instances, we had to move on to the next village, which was often a Muslim village. When we approached the villagers in a Muslim community and apprehensively asked them whether they would allow us to drill a well in their village and if they would please tell us where to locate it, we were surprised to hear them say, "Yes, absolutely, drill it anywhere you want, right in the middle where everyone can get to it easily." It was so easy. What we were offering them was identical, a well with a hand pump on it. But the way it was received was very different, simply because of religion. It was frustrating to witness, confusing maybe. Oh, it was fascinating to witness, confusing maybe, but fascinating nonetheless. I worked with mostly Hindus and Muslims, but often tribal Adivasis, Jains, and Sikhs. The Adivasis were teachers and laborers. The Sikhs and Jains were mainly shopkeepers and businessmen. Each religious group had different attitudes and contributions to offer on a wide variety of topics, and I strove to discover how each differed from the others on important matters such as birth, death, and marriage, for example. Each religion had interesting aspects to it, and I was intrigued by them all. For my part, however, I was intent on formulating a set of beliefs that would explain the universe and our place in it that was concise and that would be as valid anywhere in the universe as it was here on planet Earth. I rejected all established religions that relied on complex stories and which were tied to particular places on the face of planet Earth. Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Sikhism, and Islam were all too tied to story and place and were therefore not universal enough to satisfy these criteria, in my opinion. I began to think, what is a belief in something that would be universally true no matter where in the universe an individual's point of view was? It was a big question. My answer, after much thought, was the universe itself. As an entity, the universe is where everything takes place, a place for everything to occur. Next, I asked myself, is everything in the universe the same or equal? Or is the universe diverse? My answer, all things are not the same in the universe. Some things are alive, while others are not alive. Life exists in the universe, and having and living things are unique from non-living things in important ways. The universe provides a place for life to exist. And that sense, in that sense, life comes from the universe. So to review, we have the universe and we have life in the universe. Is all life equal and the same, or is life also varied and diverse? Life is full of diversity, and the ultimate distinction among living things is that some living things can think or reason. They are special and are distinct from other living things in important ways. They have intelligence, can think, and are aware of themselves and the world around them. They are sentient. They are alive, and they know that they are alive. They are the most advanced of the various life forms. So this was my conclusion and my realization. Number one, the universe is the place where everything occurs. Number two, life, unique from non-living things, comes from the universe. Number three, sentient living things come from life, distinct from other life forms. I was satisfied with this view of the universe. It included everything and had no particular story behind it, tying it to any particular time or place. It seemed to be universally true no matter where in the universe the point of view. It satisfied all of my requirements. It was good. I returned from my Peace Corps service after extending my 2-year commitment one extra year and continued my undergraduate degree in architecture after an 8-year leave of absence. As I explained what I had been doing in the intervening years to my fellow students and professors, I came to an amazing realization. The relationship between among my three truths bore a striking resemblance to the Christian Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. First, the universe, which is the Father. Second, life, which is the Son, coming from the Father. And third, sentiency, coming from the Son. Unknowingly and without intending to, I had proved that a Trinity exists, not the Trinity, but rather a Trinity. This surprised me. I had not set out to prove anything and was attempting only to discover truths that would simply be universal, truths that we might recognize in other sentient beings if and when they come someday to our planet and introduce themselves to us. These three intersecting truths I conceived of while in India as a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1960s may be such a universal set of precepts. The truths exist, they are so.